You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered community radio. And this is Monica Hadley. This is Writer's Voices with Monica and usually Caroline, but we have a guest co-host with us here today, Bob Ferguson, who's been in Fairfield. How long have you been here, Bob?
6 years.
6 years?
6 years.
I thought it was longer than that.
Well, I've been in and out of Fairfield for almost 26 years.
Okay.
But back here full-time for 6 years.
All right. Well, welcome back.
Well, it's great to be here.
And we've got a beautiful, sunny January morning here. Great day for solar power because, you know, a lot of times people think that the solar energy is only available in the summertime. But in winters here in Iowa, we actually can produce as much solar energy as we can in the summer. This actually leads very well into our topic today. Do you want to introduce our guest today?
Absolutely. Our guest today is Peter Fusaro, who is chairman and founder of Global Change Associates. Peter is not only a world-renowned energy finance expert, a sought-after speaker, a professor associated with three universities, I believe, Peter, Bard College, Columbia, and University of Michigan, on the Carbon Trading Board in Australia, et cetera, et cetera. It would take a very long time to tell you everything about Peter and his accomplishments. But we are just delighted to have you today here today with us, Peter, and talking about the new energy economy, what that means, what's carbon trading, how did you become an author, and all those good things. So, Monica, over to you.
Thanks, Bob. And I do want to mention that Peter is coming to Fairfield, and we'll talk more about the details of that as we go on with today's show. If you're listening to us live, this is Friday, January 4th. If you're listening to the rebroadcast on Monday morning, you're still going to have time to catch Peter, who's coming on Tuesday, January 8th. So, Peter, welcome to Writer's Voices.
I'm glad to be here.
And you're calling us from sunny California, right?
Yes, from San Francisco. It's been sunny every day we've been here.
Oh, that's kind of unusual for San Francisco, I think.
Especially in the wintertime, it's usually the rainy season.
That's right. Now, Peter, when Bob sent me the press release about your upcoming visit, what caught my eye is that you are the author of 16 books. Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
No, not at all. I didn't even get great grades in English in high school.
So what launched you on your writing career?
Well, I was giving a lot of public speaking talks, and a friend of mine suggested to me that I write a book, and so she put me in touch with a couple of agents in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, of all places, and I sent a book proposal to them, and it was kind of, they weren't really interested, but somehow it found its way to McGraw-Hill in New York, and make a long story short, that was the beginning of kind of a writing spurt. So the first book was Energy Risk Management in 1998. That's kind of the primer on energy trading and risk management. And then over the years, I've worked with a number of different publishers, John Wiley, Palgrave Macmillan, Oxford University Press, etc. And I was doing a book with Wiley, and at that point, Enron was going down into bankruptcy, and I suggested a book to them, and they said, well, we're really not interested in a book on this. I said, okay. So that was December 2001. And then in March, almost the Ides of March, March 15th, they said, can you do a book for us in 2 weeks? And I literally wrote a book, which became a New York Times bestseller, What Went Wrong at Enron, in 2 weeks for them. And the reason it was a bestseller, to be honest with you, because there's 22 books on Enron, it was the first book on Enron.
Wow.
They've got heavy promotion at every Barnes & Noble, airport, kiosk, etc. So I've written quite a few books. The last book was the Oxford University book, Energy and Environmental Project Finance, which I use in my renewable energy course at Columbia. That book took 2 years. It's 900 pages. It has a number of contributing authors, really experts in renewable energy from throughout the country.
Well, Peter, there's a couple of interesting points that I want to delve into further in that story. One is, it just happened to make its way to McGraw-Hill, your first book proposal. Okay, there's got to be more to the story than that.
No, it did. I got a call from an editor in, it was in Illinois, actually, and he had called me about the book proposal. I didn't know who he was, and I think the agents just passed along the proposal.
Okay, so...
I recall.
Had the agents...
There was a little bit of serendipity there.
Yeah, the agents turned you down as a client but passed it on? Or did they take you as a client?
The thing about my books is I kind of write books on topics that don't exist. So literally, I wrote the first book on energy risk management, the first book on Enron, et cetera. So my books kind of fall into a vacuum. You can't really categorize or catalog books that don't have any kind of topics that existed before.
Mm, okay.
So it's kind of hard for people to understand that.
Yeah.
Kind of my joke is I see things that other people don't see, and then I've got to tell everybody about it.
Now, McGraw-Hill, of course, is a premier publisher, and certainly very fortunate to have your first book come out with them. Why did you go to different publishers with different books? Was there a purpose for that?
Yeah, McGraw-Hill would not do my second book.
Oh.
So I actually self-published that book,
okay.
Energy Derivatives. And then the third book, I met an editor from John Wiley, and we hit it off, and he was in Chicago, not New York, and I actually ended up doing four books with John Wiley. And McGraw-Hill, I went back to them years later, and they said, look, your book wasn't a big seller, and we're not interested in doing any books with you, which I thought, okay, I'm a best-selling author, I've done a number of books, so it's kind of not being a vagabond, but literally I've worked with a number of different publishers on different book projects.
Now, you say your most recent book was Oxford University Press, which of course is extremely prestigious. Did that have an impact on the book, the fact that it came out from Oxford? Did that change things for you at all?
Well, I was very interested in working with Oxford University Press. They had approached me, and I actually have a co-author on that, Andrea Kramer, who's a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery, a Chicago-based law firm, and we did this together. And that book, actually, I'm pretty proud of. It was a two-year process to get that whole thing put together. It was almost an army. And I used that as my textbook in my Columbia course, but that wasn't written as a textbook. It just happened. You know, I actually believe a lot in serendipity. So I wrote the book before Columbia approached me to be a professor and teach renewable energy. So now we have the textbook. And the kids complain about the book. It's quite expensive. It's $269. And what I've done is I've talked to the librarian at Columbia, and they can scan up to 20% of a book. So I've had them scan a number of the chapters.
Mm. Now,
my books are not cheap, except the Enron book. They're all very expensive.
I was going to say, is the Enron book the only book that was written for a mass audience?
Yes.
And how was that writing process different for you than your normal one? Other than being much faster, obviously.
Well, they literally gave me a deadline of April 1, and I wrote 65,000 words in 2 weeks. I was almost on bread and water. I live in New York, and I would literally give myself a break and walk around the park, Central Park, a little bit, but I actually was writing from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day, and then ordering in food just to meet that deadline.
Did you have to sort of dumb down the language that you were accustomed to using in writing?
Yes, but I kind of have a facility to make complexity simple. I mean, I'm not writing for the 100 quants on Wall Street, so I literally try to make things easy to understand. I don't like to use acronyms, even in public speaking. I try to make it much more universal, but this book is very easy read. I actually make a joke. It's an airplane read.
Mm. Does it still sell?
It still sells, not so much, and some professors actually use it in their business school courses still.
Interesting.
Because it was the first of the scandals of 2002.
When you started writing, did you already have a complete understanding of what was going on there? Or how did you fit research into that two-week period?
Well, I was visiting Enron from 1990 pretty consistently, and I kind of knew how they ticked. It was very funny when I was introduced to a number of the people on the trading desk in 1990. it kind of surprised me they were all bankers. So, here I am in Houston, Texas, on the trading desk, and everyone was a banker from either Bankers Trust or J.P. Morgan or whatever. And then it dawned on me that they were really using the financial engineering techniques of Wall Street and applying it to the energy industry very aggressively.
Did you see that then as a problem before it actually became a problem?
No, because at first it was just, you know, they were a natural gas company that was kind of legitimate, really wasn't doing a lot of bad things. But as they got bigger and bigger, and as the analysts on Wall Street kept hyping the stock prices, and as people like Jeff Skilling started talking about how they were bigger than Exxon, I knew they were totally off base. I mean, there was just something rotten there to the core, and they were making claims, and they were getting into markets where they had no knowledge or expertise. And make a long story short, some people that are ex-Enron employees are very angry about my book still. They won't talk to me.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. And I have a lot of friends, you know, in the Houston energy trading community, because I've literally written a number of primers on this, which are used as textbooks and teaching materials. But, you know, it was, like I said, it was the first of many books on Enron, and ironically, almost every best-selling author of the Enron books had approached me about their Enron book. So it was kind of interesting. I had a kind of an insight who was doing what.
In what way did they approach you as to ask you questions about what you
knew? They wanted
to
compare notes. They wanted information from me. I mean, I had a lot of information on Enron. We had done a report on Enron in 2001, questioning some of their business practices, and it was a heavy seller in the energy industry. It was called Enron 2001, An Inside View.
So they were probably not too happy with you even before the last book.
No. The Enron actually it called us and said, well, we want this report. I said, absolutely not. If you want to buy it, we can buy it from us. So they did. But, you know, the bottom line is it was a very balanced account of things they did right, things they did wrong, how they treated people, how they graded people on a 1 to 5 scale. It was pretty insightful, actually.
Well, Peter, you mentioned that you're very good at taking complex topics and putting them in, shall I say, layman's terms. So can we move to trying to do that with carbon trading? You know, that's something that probably most people, anyone who reads the news anyway or listens to the news, has heard the term carbon trading, carbon offsets. But I don't know that so many of us actually know what that means.
Okay, sure. Basically, what we're talking about is cap and trade, which means you turn an emissions cap, you allow a finite number of carbon allowances to be emitted, and then over time, you reduce the number of allowances, and the idea behind it is to make industry innovate. And this has occurred successfully in the acid rain program in the Northeast, which we had a very severe acid rain problem, which was ameliorated because of trading, as well as an urban ozone problem in 22 states. So this idea of cap and trade, which was invented on Wall Street from mortgage-backed securities, actually has been a very successful model to reduce pollution in a much more cost-effective manner. Now, there's a lot of pushback from folks calling it cap and tax, but the reality is it is a market-based solution to reduce pollution. And here's the irony of all ironies. In 1992, the U.S. delegation at the first Rio Climate Convention meeting actually proposed cap and trade. Ironically, the Europeans were opposed to it, but making a long story short, now 194 nations have embraced cap and trade. So it has become very mainstream as a market-based solution for reducing pollution, and it's very cost-effective. What it actually does, the market sets the price for pollution, and an economist like to call them environmental externalities, but what it does is gives time for industry to basically change their business practices either with new technology or plant closures or whatever. And it has worked very, very effectively. And I'm sitting here today in California, which just several days ago launched its cap and trade program for carbon, California being the 12th largest emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet. And it, the price of carbon is touching about $15 a ton today. And in my opinion, this will be a highly successful program that will become the federal program in 5 years.
Now, who is setting the caps, and how is that enforced?
Government, the California Air Resources Board.
Okay. And how are they allocated to people who are polluting? How are they originally allocated?
Well, this is the idea. What you need is a baseline. So in California, we'll use that as an example, they use 1990 as the baseline, and the target is a 25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. It's a very aggressive program. It really means that industry has to innovate through renewable energy, energy efficiency, and basically cleaner energy sources to meet those goals. And the way the market works, if folks dawdle, the price actually continues to go up. So if you wait till 2019 to act, you're going to pay a lot more, not only for the carbon credits, but also for the financial penalties that no one likes to talk about. So behind these regimes, there are actually teeth of financial compliance. So if you do nothing, you're going to pay very dearly and also pay penalties on top of that.
And the trade aspect is that somebody who has a certain amount of allowance can trade that to, and doesn't need it, can trade it to somebody who does?
That's exactly correct. The way it's set up, though, there are a finite number of allowances. So it's not like a normal commodity market where in economic theory you can have an infinite amount of pork bellies or corn or oil. Here you actually ratchet down the number of allowances that are given by government. Now, they're also auctioned off by government. So it's kind of a hybrid of both public and private sector. The public sector setting the allowance scheme and the private sector having to not just buy allowances and trade carbon, but actually start innovating in terms of their business practices. So the second largest market is the emissions trading scheme in the EU. They're in phase three beginning this year. They will require a 20% reduction of 1990 allowances by 2020, and they will also be pushing very heavily energy efficiency and renewable energy and not allowing the buying of what we call carbon offsets.
So, Peter, this is Bob. Annie Leonard, you know, of Story of Stuff, did a fairly unflattering little view of cap and trade. I think making the assertion that Wall Street is so corrupt and these traders are going to find ways of manipulating and all that, and the whole thing's going to just be a big old boondoggle, and the people who are used to getting rich are going to get rich, and the other people who are not getting rich are not going to get rich. I know there's a very good answer to why this is both a great thing for the environment, which I think you've shown, but what's the upside for companies, and how does a regime like this actually work so people can't manipulate? We see the stuff that happens on Wall Street all the time, or we think that happens on Wall Street all the time. You know, how? What are the safeguards? How does this thing really work? What do the guts look like?
Well, the guts are you have government not only as the regulator but also as the compliance entity, and because they are monitoring market disturbances, if any. And by the way, the carbon problems have been minuscule compared to the volume traded globally, but the press has had a field day talking about how this is financial manipulation and a whole bunch of stuff. The reality is that everybody's missing sight of the long-term goal, which this is the only mechanism we have developed as a world to reduce pollution. And you can talk about carbon taxes till the cows come home, but that's never going to get any traction in political circles to get votes in Congress or anywhere else. So the reality is government entity regulates the market. Government entity has compliance officers. It's a very compliance-driven market, and you got to be pretty mad to want to violate laws where you pay economic penalties as well as get an environmental black eye in front of the press. And so using the analog of the Acid Rain program, there was only one violation in that program since 1995. One. Now, why is that? Because the economic sanction is $2,300 a ton for non-compliance. That's a very steep financial penalty. In the EU, it's 100 euro for non-compliance. That's 100 euro per ton. So you have to have what I call financial teeth to make the market work.
And Peter, you're on the Carbon Trading Board in Australia. How has it worked there?
Very similarly, it's called Carbon Trade Exchange. It's the same idea. Australia has a carbon regime to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's a very simple program there, which is growing. There is a learning curve, which I've always noted in these markets. Initially, you don't have so many market participants, but by the end of each trading deadline, which would be 2020 in Australia. And the idea behind this is really a 40-year program. We're talking about the goal of reducing greenhouse gases by 80% in the OECD, the developed countries. So this is only the first step in Australia or Europe or California to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we have a big road ahead of us. And someone with a lot of foresight realized that in the Acid Rain program, which is our best analog, that program goes to 2035. So we're talking decades of reductions in emissions, not annual at all. It's a very long-term economic strategy.
You know, Peter, another commonly held belief is that these things, these kinds of programs, while you may be able to justify them for environmental reasons, which, you know, good enough, we do want to survive as a species. On the other hand, there always seems to be a sense that, well, these are just going to be very costly to industry. It's not going to be good for industry. It's going to cost jobs and everything. My reading of this is it's exactly the opposite. It actually spurs innovation and creates wealth in the company. So how does that work? How does a regime like this with teeth, you know, sanctions, and, you know, out and out, you're going to do this or you're going to pay dearly. How is this a good thing for companies?
Well, there is an obvious cost to doing this. I mean, this is no free rider issue here. The bottom line is if you innovate early, you're probably going to get better benefits than waiting to the end of each trading period, which in this case of California will be 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050. On top of that, there is an ability to actually make money selling the credit. So if you're under your allowance cap, you can sell your emissions credits to other entities that are over the cap. So it actually becomes a profit center as well. And so, make a long story short, the definitive studies on how cost-effective this have been done by MIT, the energy lab run by Dr. Danny Ellerman up there in Cambridge. They've done the seminal studies evaluating not only cap and trade for Acid Rain, but also cap and trade for the EU ETS. And the Pew Center also has a number of reports showing how cost-effective these mechanisms have worked, despite it costs too much to do this. My argument, it costs too much not to do this, because the reality is the benefits are cleaner air. We've already seen this twice in the United States, and I think that model has been replicable all over the world. I mean, no one beside some climate deniers out there, has really, you know, had shown that this doesn't work.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, your host, and my guest host today is Bob Ferguson, and our author guest is Peter Fusaro, who is the founder of the Wall Street Green Trading Summit and the author of 16 books, including What Went Wrong at Enron. Peter, one thing as I'm listening to you describe the carbon trading markets is I'm wondering, it seems like there's sort of local regional markets. Wouldn't it make more sense for it to be at least national, if not international?
Well, that was there are two questions in there. Let's first talk about what went wrong in Washington. And the reality is we had the Waxman-Markey bill, which passed the House in June 2009, which adopted cap and trade, and then we never saw a Senate bill put on the floor for a vote. And we would need 60 votes in the Senate to have federal legislation on carbon cap and trade. And I worked 20 years on that market, by the way, 20 years, trained over 1,000 people on carbon trading and finance, briefed Congress staff, embassies, and federal agencies on this, and many, many, many people believe this was all going to happen in 2010, and it never came to a vote in the Senate. So we lost that opportunity for federal legislation. Consequently, what we have left is a 10-state small program in the Northeast called REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, but the price for carbon is $1.93 a ton, not particularly material. As I mentioned before, California is touching $15 a ton. Internationally, the United States did not sign the Kyoto Protocol. 194 nations have signed the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol ended at the end of 2012 and has been rolled over into kind of a less efficient mechanism for monitoring and curtailing global pollution. Here's the bigger problem. The carbon footprint of the world in 2011, our latest data, was 31.6 billion metric tons of CO2. So when you combust fossil energy, that's oil, gas, and coal, you are creating CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions that will remain in the stratosphere for 100 years. So that's the first problem. The second problem is this is transnational. It's way beyond any border. So if you're combusting coal in China, it's going to have a global impact. It's not going to have only a regional impact. And the thinking was that behind the Kyoto Protocol, that the developed countries, which were called the OECD countries, which are 38, would facilitate cleaner energy solutions for the developing countries. So they would follow a cleaner energy path and would be paid on a project-by-project basis. There are about 4,600 projects that were approved by the Clean Development Mechanism Executive Board in Bonn to actually get this done. Now, make a long story short, only the UK and Sweden met their Kyoto targets, which was a 5.2% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 1990. Other countries did not. The price for carbon in the developed world slumped to less than 1 euro, and the euro is about $1.30 in U.S. dollars, and carbon in the EU today is around 6.5 euro per ton. So having very low prices for greenhouse gas emissions takes a lot of mitigation techniques off the table. The idea is to have economic pain to incent industry to change. By having very cheap carbon pricing, folks just buy the credits and don't change behavior. And that's not the outcome you want.
And how is that pricing determined? Who's setting it?
It's set by markets. There are a number of exchanges. There's the European carbon exchange. There are a number of different entities out there. There's the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which clears many of these contracts. There's an entity called the Green Exchange. So make a long story short, there are a number of financial players that were very active in carbon trading and finance. Now, where we sit today in 2013 is the nexus of a lot of this activity is only really in two major markets. One is California, as I mentioned, the 12th largest emitter of greenhouse gases. The second is the EU. And these are the two biggest markets. There are smaller markets in Australia, and there will be emerging markets in China. One of my projects at Columbia is to analyze this semester with my students seven emissions markets in China. This is very material because between China and the United States, we're talking about over 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And the Chinese have also adapted cap and trade as their mechanism for reducing pollution. And I've been to China three times, and believe me, they got a terrific pollution problem there.
Why are the market prices so low if the government penalties for not, you know, for exceeding it are, I assume, quite a bit higher than that? Are they not being enforced?
There wasn't an enforcement problem. It's just that the credits became oversupplied in the market, and therefore they became almost non-material in changing behavior. And there have been some problems with the projects not producing the number of credits anticipated. There's been a lot of bureaucratic problems, but where we're going with all of this is to really either a country-by-country approach or a regional approach. At some juncture, we're going to have a North American market for carbon. Quebec is linking with California today, so there are impetuses here to start moving things forward. We have the regional market of the EU. We'll probably have a single Chinese market because they're so big. There's an Indian market, which is still embryonic. But the point is, these different markets have to link. And right now we're looking at something that's still prescriptive rather than a done deal. It still hasn't gelled to the way many of us thought we would move. So right now the highest price for carbon is California. Second is the EU. And that's kind of the order of magnitude of where we see biggest reductions coming for greenhouse gases.
So, Peter, you know, it sounds like you've devoted quite a bit of your professional life to this topic, but you're also kind of moving into this topic of the new energy economy, which is what you're coming to Fairfield to talk about. So I'm going to let you and Bob talk about that.
Well, terrific. Thank you, Monica. So, Peter, what's a definition of the new energy economy? What do we mean by that?
Well, basically, it's using energy in a much more sustainable way. So the first thing, obviously, is renewable energy, which doesn't really require or create much pollution nor fuel. You're talking about the sun, the wind, the oceans, the tide, geothermal, etc. It's also looking at energy efficiency as a market driver. You know, the metric ton of carbon not produced actually is the cheapest form of energy. So the U.S. economy being built on cheap and abundant natural resources is probably the most energy inefficient of the 38 developed nations. So there's a major opportunity for energy efficiency. And then you've got newer technologies, such as energy management systems, such as systems to look at the building envelope. That's how a building uses energy. Buildings are about 40% of greenhouse gases. So there are very simple fixes like retrofitting with lighting systems with LED lamps, or looking at the heating and cooling systems called HVAC. So the game is to bring better technology or more efficient technology into markets and use energy, in my opinion, in a much more environmentally benign way, and that's the key. So it's not a simple fix. Obviously, it costs money to do this, but the payback periods on lighting systems can be less than a year these days because of technology. The movement to renewable energy, we have an idea called bending the cost curve. So today you can get solar panels out of China almost below market costs. And there are a number of entities that I've been meeting with here out in California looking at community solar. So in the United States, California is the leader in solar energy. Ironically, New Jersey is number two. Why? Because they had state-level incentive programs. And what I see emerging now is not federal. It's really driven by either local jurisdictions, state-level incentives, some federal incentives. We just passed the production tax credit for wind. Unfortunately, it's only extended for 1 year. We have very myopic federal policies that keep having a boom-bust dimension to them. But what you have, though, in 29 states are renewable portfolio standards, which very simply means that the electric and gas utilities have to purchase a certain percentage of renewable energy. Now, here in California, that goal is 33% of electric power in this state by 2020. And once again, there's a financial penalty for not purchasing that amount of renewable energy. So what we've seen occur in this new economy is very little federal effort and a lot more state and local effort and incentives to move forward with efficiency and or renewable energy. Now, getting to fossil energy, the only big thing that's been done under the Obama administration is moving the CAFE standards, the corporate fuel economy standards, up to, I think it's 55 miles per gallon by 2025. That will create a lot of innovation in transportation. The two biggest sources of pollution in the United States are buildings and transportation.
Now, Peter, a couple of questions. Number one, I think, again, in some people's minds, they may be questioning whether renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, is really cost effective. Can we talk a little bit about that bending the cost curve or driving the cost curve down with adoption? In other words, the more technology is adopted, the cheaper it gets, and you can, by incenting to begin with, to prime the pump, so to speak, you can then get to the point where incentives are not so necessary. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, that's exactly true. The holy grail is to reduce cost and scale technology. And we're not quite at grid parity for solar, but we're getting there. We are probably very close to grid parity for wind. And it really depends, you know, on what the electric retail cost is in different areas of the country. In some states, like on the coast, particularly in the Northeast and California, it's very, very expensive. So there are just economic incentives because the payback periods are shorter for renewables. And the good news is, you know, we're talking on photovoltaic, what we call PV solar, you know, 20-year warranty on panels, probably 6-7 year payback, and there are also tax incentives called the ITC that are also involved in that. So there's nothing wrong with jump-starting an industry with subsidies. You know, people don't think about subsidies for other industries, but we subsidize the coal industry, we subsidize the oil and gas industry, we subsidize the agricultural industry. So I don't see what the big brouhaha about subsidizing renewable energy is. Renewable energy is going to be around for decades, and the reality is we're just getting started. About 7% of the U.S. template for power is renewable today. It's quite small.
Well, and I think, Peter, particularly when you're talking about technologies that are subject to Moore's Law, like PV panels. So, you know, that really is interesting. Another issue I think in the back of people's minds is, again, what's the social cost of doing all of this? What's the balance of payment, so to speak, between what it's going to cost, what we're going to have to invest, and then what do we get out of this? Now, on one level, it's easy to see that if you're using less energy, you're using free fuel, or you're doing a project that pays off in 7 years and the panels were guaranteed for 20, and I know from experts that there are panels that have been functioning for 50 years, that's fairly easy to see. What I think may be harder for people to see is, let's say, the reduction in healthcare costs that are associated with cleaner air and other reductions of actual real costs that we actually pay. The emitter may not pay, they may not be paid locally, but they're paid globally.
The reduction of military costs for not having to protect oil rigs in the Middle East?
Well, absolutely. So I'd like to have benefit of your knowledge of what are some of these externalities that are actually costing us dearly that we don't necessarily popularly think of as costs associated with pollution and combusting fossil fuels and that kind of thing?
Well, you're really talking about the environmental externalities, the external cost for this, and I'm not aware of any cost-benefit analysis studies done by EPA on healthcare costs, but it certainly makes a lot of sense. I'll give you an analog, which I'm quite familiar with. In 1976, I worked at the Federal Energy Administration, which was the predecessor agency to the U.S. Department of Energy. And my boss said to me, we're going to have gasoline shortages taking the lead out of gasoline. So those in the audience will probably remember, we used to have leaded gasoline. And I was dispatched to work with EPA in Research Triangle Park on taking the lead out of gasoline because there were going to be gasoline shortages. But lo and behold, there was one magnificent thing that happens. When you give an engineer a problem to solve, they not only solve the problem, they exceed the standards. So not only were there no gasoline shortages due to lead phase down, it was called, I took that same concept of taking lead out of gasoline, which took us 20 years, by the way, to Asia and became an influencer changing public policy in four countries. And I was kind of the accidental tourist. I would speak at energy conferences about reformulation of fuels. That's what they called it. The good news is in 2 years, there will be no lead in gasoline in the whole world. Now, why is this important? The first thing, lead is a known carcinogen which impacted and affected children's health and also caused asthmas and all kinds of respiratory problems. But there was another unintended consequence that epidemiologists surfaced a couple of years ago. By taking the lead out of gasoline, it reduced crime in the inner cities. It reduced attention deficit disorder. It actually had other benefits that no one had ever predicted or anticipated. And I was told this by doctors 2 years ago, and I was flabbergasted. So there's a analog of reducing pollution, giving industry time to innovate to basically unleaded gasoline, and the environmental and health outcomes were substantially greater than anybody ever predicted.
Yes, I read a study on that. Apparently, the latest research is showing that the amount of tolerance that our system has for lead is much lower than we thought. The impacts are much greater than we thought in terms of, reducing even things like reducing IQ, reducing the capacity of brains to function, and particularly if children are exposed to lead very early. So, that's really an excellent example. So, Peter, I think that we might want to talk a little bit about why you're coming to Iowa. We're going to be spending, I say we broadly, True Market Solutions, which is a co-sponsor of your trip here. is going to be presenting to the mayor and political and business leaders in Dubuque. We're going to be hearing about all the wonderful progress there for half a day, and then we're going to be talking about what True Market Solutions is doing around the country. And I know you're working with us to bring the TMS programs to Manhattan. I'd just love to have you talk a little bit about where you see this idea of learning circles, peer learning circles of companies that get together and work on their own projects, but work together collaboratively, working through a curriculum that helps them look at all of the aspects of sustainable business value. And I should say that's whether they're a for-profit business, a nonprofit, a governmental entity. So where do you think this, you know, fits in, and what are we going to be talking to the good folks at Dubuque about?
Well, sustainability circles, which is the outcome of True Market Solutions program, in my opinion, is a very innovative way of teaching sustainability on a peer-to-peer basis. What is created is a program of business, government, entities under a six-month auspices to actually create sustainability action plans. It's really affecting behavioral change, which is way beyond just talking about return on investment for energy efficiency or waste minimization or water management. It's actually getting into the DNA of companies and government to change behavior. And as far as I know, it is probably the most successful program for small and medium-sized enterprises in the country. There are a number of single shingle consultants out there. There are a number of large entities like the Walmarts of the world that have embraced sustainability. But actually, looking at this as peer-to-peer learning has additional value, in my opinion, that has really looking at an untapped human resource within companies to actually do their own innovation and partner with energy service providers and other entities. So what we're doing in Iowa is presenting some pretty novel ideas that empower behavioral change, but also empower employees and supervisors to really embrace sustainability on an ongoing basis. This is not a one-off. So when you're looking at energy efficiency or renewable energy or looking at waste reductions, you're actually looking at a cost that dropped to the bottom line. These become very economic and beneficial cost reductions.
You know, and Peter, Chris Laszlo's notion, the professor at Case Western, that sustainable business value can be considered a nested set of values that starts with risk mitigation. First rule, don't die. You know, second benefit, what we would call eco-efficiency. Then it goes on to an evaluation of one's products, the markets you're serving, brand and reputation, industry leadership. And wrapping that whole construct is the idea of radical innovation. We have just a couple minutes more, but I'd love to hear your take on how driving sustainability into the DNA of the organization, we called embedded sustainability. That's Chris's term that we have adopted in True Market Solutions. How does embedding sustainability require radical innovation? And what does radical innovation have to do with the profitability of your company or the effectiveness of your government or the effectiveness of the service delivery of your nonprofit?
Well, the real issue is, you know, I used to make the joke, no one rips out energy conservation. The point is that the benefit is long-term. I mean, this is not a short-term quick fix. This is actually a much more beneficial way of doing business, because you're reducing costs for many, many years, but you're also making the workplace a much more enjoyable environment. The point is that I think when people get active on projects, they get empowered. I see this with my grad students all the time, that they take ownership of actually doing the sustainability metrics. And I've been doing this such a long time, it didn't even have a name called sustainability or green. It's just kind of second nature. And I see this becoming much more mainstream. Now, part of the process, obviously, is education and learning. But I think once it becomes the embedded DNA of a company or a government entity, I think it's there for the long haul.
And that embedded sustainability, there are many, many examples of companies that have become extraordinarily more profitable because of all those benefits, including, you know, enlivening their workforce, as Ray Anderson, the late Ray Anderson of Interface Carpet said, you know, for jazzing up your workforce and making sucking them out of bed and making them want to come to work. And there's nothing like an embedded sustainability program to kind of get people fired up. So you're also going to be here in Fairfield. We're going to be doing a tour in the morning and a lunch with the mayor and some other folks. And then at 3 o'clock, you're going to be talking at Cambridge Investment Services on finance and the new energy economy. I presume that's going to be quite a bit more quantitative and sort of more technical, but also very, very accessible, something valuable for other people. And then in the evening at the Sustainable Living Center on MUM's campus, very intriguing topic, microgrids, the power of local in bringing about the new energy economy. If you could just speak for a moment about what you'll be going over at Cambridge and at MUM, I think we'll be wrapping up after that.
And that's on Tuesday, January 8th.
Yes, Tuesday, January 8th.
Yeah, I want to mention one thing. I'm really looking forward coming to Iowa. My wife is from Iowa. She was from a little town called Lakota. And went to Iowa State before she went on to Juilliard in New York City. So I'm very looking forward to coming to Iowa. I've been there in quite a while. Basically, you know, the bigger issue, and this is the last 6 months of my life, I've kind of become much more expert at sort of the whole concept of the microgrid. It's going back to the small is beautiful. And actually looking at a number of different technologies, be they PV solar or small-scale wind power or fuel cell technology. And in Iowa, I think there's going to be a lot of resonance with something called anaerobic digestion, which is using animal waste or agricultural waste to create a biogas that can turn a turbine. So we're going back to a model that started with Edison in New York City on Water Street over 100 years ago of small-scale energy production called distributed energy. And more recently, I have been involved the last 10 years in certain projects in India and the Philippines. The Philippines on anaerobic digestion, this manure management process that creates a biogas that creates electricity. And in India, also doing the same thing for lighting in villages at the bottom of the pyramid. Now, what is really interesting to me now is I'm taking that concept of the microgrid now to my own country, to the United States. You know, central power stations are very, very expensive. We call that capital intensive. And we're talking about small-scale solutions to create electric power that has a number of economic benefits. It's cheaper, it's sustainable, it's local, and it's going back to a very different paradigm that we really had 100 years ago. So I'm very interested in seeing how this gestates, not only in Iowa, but also in other entities in the U.S., because there are opportunities in the developing world where 1.3 billion people do not have electricity, but now we see the same technologies can be applied in our own country. So this is quite fascinating in that it's going to be a much cleaner, greener, cheaper way of creating energy.
Well, Peter, Fairfield's a great place to discuss that because we certainly have those initiatives going on here, including two commercial buildings that I'm a partner in that are powered by solar energy. So thank you. We're out of time, completely out of time. But thank you so much for joining us today, Peter and Bob. And if you've been listening, this has been Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley. My co-host today was Bob Ferguson. Our guest was Peter Fusaro, who will be coming next week. And why don't you give the full details of that again, and we'll wrap it up.
Peter will be doing a talk at 3 p.m. That's Tuesday, January 8th at Cambridge Investment Research. And again at 7:30 p.m. at the Sustainable Living Center on the MUM campus. As you just heard, we'll be talking about finance and also the microgrid, the power of local, and whatever else Peter wants to talk about, which I'm sure will be plenty and very interesting.
And this is co-sponsored by KRUU-FM.
And True Market Solutions.
Next week on Writers' Voices, Caroline will be back with me in the studio for the first time in several months. We'll be interviewing local author Norman Zierold, a conversational memoir that reminds me, talking about his days in the golden days of Hollywood. So looking forward to that. See you next week.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.